20-something engineers now design products for aging baby boomers. But it's hard for them to feel the aches and limitations of a 75-year-old. So the Age Lab at MIT has come up with a special suit that does just that. While reporting her recent series on aging, NPR's Jennifer Ludden tried it on.
Okay, I'm 40-something. No spring chicken. But hey, if the crosswalk light is blinking, I can still dash across the street, no problem.
Step in. You can take your shoes off.
Until, that is, Rosanne Pulio starts strapping me into her age suit. I pull a harness around my waist. Then Pulio, a researcher at MIT, starts attaching things to it.
So this piece will connect right to your back, and then it will stretch down to the bottom of the shoes, so it will limit your hip flexion.
That means no more sprinting. Pulio also attaches stretchy rubber bands to restrict my arms, knee pads and Velcro wrist braces, gloves to lessen sensation in my fingers. Everything on the suit is carefully calibrated to mimic the loss of function that happens as we age. Finally, there's a hard hat to clip more things onto.
We attach the bungee cords to the Velcro straps on the helmet.
I'm not going to be able to do anything.
And then you feel, so this is going to attach here.
And then I feel like this was a bad idea. At this point, it's work just to stand up straight. And to walk, Pulio has me in Croc sandals with bits of rubber foam on the bottom. It's not that I've lost my balance.
But the act of having to balance makes you more fatigued, makes you more tired.
Researchers here say, of course, baby boomers aren't the first ones to get old, but they're the first to demand some product or service to make the process easier. And that's the Age Lab's mission. Pulio has outfitted grad students in this age suit and taken them grocery shopping.
And what we found was a lot of the low sugar, low sodium items were either at the top of the shelf or at the bottom of the shelf. Not in a place where an older adult would have the easiest time locating.
Sure enough, when I step over to the Age Lab's mock grocery store, those Ritz crackers way up on the top shelf do not seem worth the trouble. Joseph Coughlin heads the Age Lab, and he wants to spread this kind of aha moment, not just to grocery chains, but also product designers and city planners.
The aha for the 30-year-old that says, wow, this box of cupcakes is hard to open. Wow, getting out of this public transportation system is more difficult than I thought.
Rosanne Pulio wants those who try on her suit to feel more empathy for seniors. I, for one, have come to appreciate that spring in my step while I still have it. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
This is NPR News. It was a bleak week for anyone looking for signs that the housing market is recovering. New home sales in July were at their weakest levels since the government began keeping records 47 years ago. Existing home sales weren't much better. But in all that news, one number jumps out. Almost a third of the home sales were all cash deals. According to the National Association of Realtors, before the housing bust, less than 10% of sales were all cash. NPR's Brett Neely has more on who these cash buyers are.
Who buys houses with a big stack of cash? Often, people like Craig Fuhrer. He's been investing in real estate around Maryland for the past 7 years. The license plate on his SUV defines his style of investing. It reads, "Flippin'."
I'm not a big vanity plate guy, but I just thought that was kind of cool, so flipping is the license plate, yeah.
At a time when the housing market is so anemic that it threatens to send the economy back into a recession, Fuhrer is a reminder that there are still people who make money investing in real estate. They tend to be very serious about it, though.
So where we're standing in front of now is Diller Avenue. It's actually in the Beverly Hills neighborhood of Baltimore.
It's a pretty neighborhood, with lots of big trees and houses from the 1920s, but it's no Southern California Beverly Hills. Fuhrer paid $63,000 in cash for this boarded-up four-bedroom house. Inside, there's debris everywhere from where Fuhrer's contractors have ripped out drywall.
Hey, dude, you got a tape measure on you by any chance?
Once the place is fixed up, Fuhrer thinks he and his investors may be able to get $250,000 for it. It's potential rewards like these that are drawing investors into the real estate market right now, says Kenneth Wenhold of the real estate research firm Metro Study.
When you're putting all cash into a particular transaction, it's an indication that you believe that this is a good price for this home and you don't think it's going to depreciate more and you're willing to bet a considerable amount of money, that it's going to start to appreciate again.
In cities across the country, there are investors like Fuhr taking advantage of depressed housing prices to snap up dozens of properties on the cheap. When they're not flipping those houses, they're turning them into rentals. Cash sales have become a big part of the market because banks are issuing fuhr mortgages. House flippers like Fuhr could once rely on bank loans to finance their deals. But no longer, says Fuhr. He has a group of investors who bankroll him.
The big hurdle that everyone has these days is just finding the money to purchase and rehab. You know, not everybody has $150,000 sitting around, and the problem is that no banks right now are lending.
Fuhr got into the real estate business at a time when banks lent to anyone with a pulse.
You could do every single thing wrong and still make money. You could purchase the house for way too much. You could take way too long to rehab it. You could rehab it poorly and still sell it on the back end and make money.
A lot of house flippers got burned by the bubble. But Fuhr is still flipping.
You know, if you've been doing this as long as we have, you know that you make your money when you purchase the house, not when you sell it.
With banks still unloading their huge portfolios of foreclosed properties, houses remain very cheap these days. Remember, Fuhr's house on Diller Avenue in Baltimore costs just $63,000. He may spend close to $100,000 renovating it. Even if the house doesn't fetch the $250,000 he thinks it will, Fuhr isn't worried.
The market could literally correct itself $50,000 or $60,000 and we would still break even.
Which means, even if housing prices stay weak, investors like Fuhr could have plenty of chances to keep making money. Brett Neely, NPR News.
It's a long drive from Maine to Delaware on I-95. Luckily, there are rest stops on the way. They range from small buildings with vending machines, maps, and restrooms, to sprawling plazas with gas stations, restaurants, and other amenities. The Delaware Travel Plaza is our destination. This stretch of I-95 through Delaware and Maryland opened in November of 1963. President John F. Kennedy did the ribbon cutting before a crowd of thousands.
It symbolizes, I believe, this highway, first of all, partnership between the federal government and the states, which is essential to the progress of all of our people.
8 days later, on a trip to Dallas, Texas, JFK was assassinated. And this part of I-95 then became known as the John F. Kennedy Memorial Highway. When the Delaware Travel Plaza opened in 1964 on I-95, just outside Newark, Delaware, there was a gas station and a round building that housed the restrooms and a restaurant. The building was very gloomy inside, and over the years, the site and the services declined precipitously. It closed after Labor Day last year. A newly renovated Delaware house opened for business this June. We visited the 42,000-square-foot roadside stopover earlier this month. Man, this place looks like an art museum. All glass. It's got a rounded roof. It's got two patios on either side. A sign that says, "Welcome to Delaware." Inside, there are 8 places to eat and 4 shops. Enough variety to satisfy a troop of Boy Scouts returning from a 100th anniversary jamboree in Washington.
I'm Trevor Ozick from Troop 114 in Massachusetts.
So, what do you think of this rest stop?
We stopped in New York, I think, coming here. It was awful. It was really dark. And this one's really, like, light. And you just walk in and you're like, it just takes your breath away.
Fred Fox is a general manager for HMS Host, the commercial operator of the facility, which is officially called the Delaware Welcome Center Travel Plaza. He's proud of its function, not just its form.
We provide restrooms 24 hours a day, clean restrooms, I might add. We provide a place to sit and, you know, just relax. We have pet exercise areas where you can take your dog and, you know, do what it needs to do, or I guess cats probably too, but I don't see too many cats traveling, but dogs for sure.
You ever thought of putting a couple of massage chairs in? No massage chairs, but there is a Z Market, touted as an upscale convenience store that sells travel essentials and gourmet prepackaged meals.
This facility is a game changer for us and for the industry.
The Delaware Travel Plaza is somewhat unique among roadside rest stops. A federal law passed in the 1960s prohibits private businesses from running state-owned rest areas, specifically to protect small businesses along interstates. But the Delaware Travel Plaza, as well as two in Maryland, were grandfathered in. And the Delaware Plaza is making money for the state. Delaware gets a percentage of the sales of food and gasoline, but no taxes. Lisa Mullings is the president and CEO of NATSO, a trade association that represents the travel plaza and truck stop industry. You know, the kind where you actually have to exit the highway to fill up the tank. She contends that there is a tax, only a hidden one.
Someone in my office called and asked, "What is the price of a hamburger at the Delaware Center?" Then she called the nearest Burger King that was independently owned off of the interstate, which is 7 miles away, and it was almost a dollar difference.
It's true that prices are higher at the Delaware Travel Plaza. Management says items there sell for about 10% more than they do at similar places off the interstate, a boon for the state. Mullings and the businesses she represents are worried that the success of the Delaware Travel Plaza might embolden other states to lobby to repeal the law that protects those local merchants at interstate exits.
There are 50% fewer businesses at the interstate exits if there's a commercialized rest area.
But travelers like Rohan Cumberbatch Smith, who is driving home to Norfolk, Virginia with his wife, Basima, say they are willing to pay for the convenience.
It's a beautiful building. It's a little bit pricey, though, the items in here. I guess once you're on the road, I have no choice. But it's beautiful.
For all its bells and whistles, the sprawling Delaware house can make one nostalgic for the old rest stop kitsch. There are still buckets of Dolly saltwater taffy and jars of Old Bay seasoning for sale. But I told Fred Fox of HMS Host that something was missing.
I have to admit I started a hobby stopping at rest stops during my travels. Invariably, there's a machine where you put in a penny and then like 50 cents and you twirl the gears and you get a squished penny with, you know, a little souvenir of the state that you're in. Is there a squished penny machine here?
No, there's not.
No? Why not?
We made a conscious decision when we reopened the facility that we were going to focus on transactions that had an actual person involved, a customer service.
Okay, no squished pennies. So I settle for a box of Mellow Mints, and we get back on Interstate 95 and make the 2-hour drive south back to Washington, D.C. Art Series I-95, The Road Most Traveled, continues on the next weekend edition Saturday with a report on the migrant workers who travel the road. And if you're planning a trip on I-95, we've got music, mini road trips, and more on our site, npr.org/I-95. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. 5 years ago, the New Orleans-based bluegrass band Truck Stop Honeymoon was on tour when Hurricane Katrina struck. They lost their home in the Ninth Ward, and their community was destroyed. But Mike West and Katie Euless didn't let that slow them down. They stayed on the road. They eventually settled in a place about as different from New Orleans as you can get, the semi-rural university town of Lawrence, Kansas. Mike West and Katie Euless of Truck Stop Honeymoon are in the studios of member station KANU in Lawrence, Kansas. Welcome, Mike.
Hi.
And welcome to you, Katie.
Hey there.
Hey there. So, of all the places in the country, why Lawrence, Kansas?
Look at a map. Where's the furthest point you can get from any coastal area in America?
No hurricanes to worry about in Kansas.
Absolutely not. Just very compact circular winds.
Yeah. And compact circular winds, I think we call them tornadoes.
Yeah, only take out a small-sized town.
Yeah, but you write a song, Kansas in the Spring, sitting in the basement with the family, listening to the sirens sing.
There are many surprising similarities between the Midwest and the Deep South.
It's another beautiful day in May, I love Kansas in the spring. Sitting in the basement with the family, listening to the sirens sing. And there ain't no place that I'd rather be. I tell you, it's a funny thing. I love New Orleans in the summertime and Kansas in the spring.
Oh, so Katie, why did you decide not to go back to New Orleans?
Well, the gardening wasn't any good after the backyard filled up with most of the industrial canal.
Well, now, come on, the squashes really took off.
We had a bumper crop of cantaloupes after the flood, but
you couldn't eat them.
No, there's other minerals that are better for the children than lead and arsenic and things like that.
I have another, an earlier album of yours. The new one is called Homemade Haircut. Mm-hmm. But I want to refer to an earlier one. There's a song you do called Mardi Gras in Kansas.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, we moved to Kansas from New Orleans. Neither of us is from the Midwest. And, you know, it's some severe cultural adjustments we had to make. And one of the adjustments we were not prepared to make was giving up Mardi Gras. We spent our first year in Kansas and let the first Mardi Gras go by uncelebrated, and our children looked mortified, you know, because after Christmas, that's what they look forward to, Mardi Gras. And they all got dressed up and ready to go out and hit the town in Lawrence, Kansas. And we had to explain that this
was... It just wasn't happening.
No, it was freezing rain.
Kind of
and, you
bleak.
Know, yeah.
Mardi Gras in Kansas ain't like it is in New Orleans. There's no marching bands, no daiquiri stands, no hookers and no drag queens. No tourists falling in the gutter as they put their margaritas away. Mardi Gras in Kansas, it's just another Tuesday.
But after that, we just promised ourselves we would not let it happen again. So, in fact, we have actually started a Mardi Gras parade here in Lawrence, Kansas, a very tiny but beautiful one.
You've established yourself there. I mean, you even call your studio the Ward 9 Pick and Parlor?
The Ninth Ward Pick and Parlor, which comes from the Ninth Ward, New Orleans, and that's what it was called when it was in New Orleans. So now it's now the Ninth Ward Pick and Parlor in Kansas. So.
And that's where you recorded the new CD.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, you start off with the title tune, Homemade Haircut. Mm-hmm. And I was curious. I mean, I wondered if this was a song about frugality or fashion.
One equaling the other at times. Ever since I was a kid, I always liked to cut my own hair. And it was an empowering thing to just get out the scissors, look in the mirror, and get chopping and see what you end up with. And usually it makes for a new outlook and a new look. And doesn't cost you a dime. And it gets you that spring back in your step when you need it sometimes.
Yeah.
As I remember shortly before we wrote that one,
our 6-year-old went upstairs and gave herself a homemade haircut. And it reminded me of so many that I had in my life that my mother so gently said, let me just straighten that out for you a little bit.
Do you think you'll ever go back to New Orleans permanently?
That's hard. No, we...
Maybe when we're elderly or something.
Yeah, it's hard to justify with the kids, you know, because we lived in the hood. And
we don't have to worry. Like, if I send Mike out to get milk at 10 o'clock at night for the morning, I don't really worry so much that he's going to get shot on the way there or back. Or just the stress of living on the defense sometimes when you live in a more edgy environment. I realized when we moved here how much energy I was spending on that. When I came here, I realized I didn't have to look over my shoulder constantly. It was okay to just take a walk with the kids. And you could pretty much trust that the ice cream man was selling ice cream. And, you know, most times the dogs stay in the backyard. Hmm. And, you know, it's just a little more relaxing.
But that's kind of a revelation you had after you moved.
Yes.
So I'm thinking if there was no hurricane, you probably would still be living there.
That's the weird thing. It's one of those changes we may never have chosen to make. You know, because it's not just, if it was just me and Katie, you'd be like, whatever, we love it. We've dealt
Let's
with it
before. Go listen to Hot Jazz at 3 in the morning,
yeah,
no
man,
problem.
You can't beat it, you know. But to make that choice for me and Katie and our 4 kids is nigh impossible. Nigh impossible, you know. We're living in... You know, a great town. We tour.
We still got chickens in the yard.
And we still got chickens because Lawrence, Kansas lets you keep chickens, which is important.
You have your instruments in the studio there, and you're going to end with a tune from Homemade Haircut. And it's actually it harkens back to everything you've said about what's happened in your life. It's called Accidentally, and yes. It talks about how good things can happen when you don't exactly plan for them.
Yes,
and you are going to play, so why don't I just say here is Mike West and Katie Ulis with a tune from their CD Homemade Haircut, and it's called Accidentally.
All right. Be-bo.
Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin. How'd he do it?
Accidentally.
And how did Kellogg make that very first cornflake? He made it
accidentally. Albert Hoffman found LSD like Isaac Newton found gravity. Like I found you and you found me and we found ourselves with a family. None of this was planned, but that's all right. Some of the best things in life happen accidentally.
I've often heard it said an Egyptian invented bread. How?
Accidentally.
And everybody know the first ice cream soda was made how?
Accidentally. Albert Hoffman found LSD like Isaac Newton found gravity. Like I found you and you found me and we found ourselves a family. None of this was planned, but that's alright. Some of the best things in life happen accidentally.
Jelly Knight, Silly Putter, that was James Wright. They were both made
accidentally.
And the Slinky and Cellophane and Radioactivity to name but a few. They were
accidental too. Albert Hoffman found LSD like Isaac Newton found gravity. Like I found you and you found me and we found ourselves a family. None of this was planned, but that's alright. Some of the best things in life happen accidentally.
Some of the best things in life happen accidentally.
Mike West and Katie Ulis are members of the band Truck Stop Honeymoon. They joined us from the studios of KANU in Lawrence, Kansas. Our thanks to the engineer there, Jason Sloat. Mike and Katie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A one, a two, a one, two, three.
You can listen to songs by Truck Stop Honeymoon at nprmusic.org.
Daddy, don't play. Daddy, don't.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. If you're going to be watching the Emmy Awards ceremony tonight, you might want to think of a nice drink to go along with it.
Mad Men is probably up for a bunch of stuff, right? So let's go with the old fashioned.
That's bartender Derek Brown.
Take a thin lemon peel, about 2 inches long, about a half of an inch wide with no pith on it. Drop it in the bottom of a rocks glass. Add about a quarter to a half ounce of simple syrup. Then add a couple dashes of the bitters of your choice. And then 2 ounces of rye whiskey. Add ice to it. Stir it until you get the dilution you want. It's a simple drink. It's delicious. And it'll make you feel like Don Draper. So, on his good days.
Derek Brown was mixing drinks and doling out wisdom behind his bar this past week. The co-owner of The Passenger in Washington, D.C.'s Penn Quarter neighborhood doesn't shy away from the title bartender, but it doesn't really do him justice. Derek Brown is more like a professor of cocktails. He's won numerous awards and this year was nominated for the James Beard Foundation Awards Outstanding Wine and Spirits Professional. Like any spot where folks gather after work to let off steam, The Passenger is boisterous. But walk toward the back, through a narrow lounge designed to look like a vintage railroad car. Open the door into the Columbia Room, and the mood changes. The Columbia Room only seats about 16 patrons. It's open several nights a week for cocktails by reservation. It's both a cocktail club and a laboratory. Twice a month, Derek Brown offers classes in cocktail making.
I'm going to get a bottle tomorrow if I could.
The cocktail revival isn't new. In the 1990s, the martini reemerged, and the last decade produced cosmopolitans of many colors and flavors. But Derek Brown proselytizes for authentic libations.
It is really an American tradition, and I think that people are in the mood to explore American ideals in a different way, that sort of Coca-Cola and hamburgers are not the only thing that America has ever created. There's great culinary traditions here. The cocktail is one of our greatest exports.
The cocktail consists of liquor, water, sugar, and bitters. But before bitters became a critical ingredient in the cocktail,
you had hundreds of different varieties of bitters that were made as curatives. They're basically there to improve your health.
Traveling medicine men peddled them out of their carts. Newspapers ran ads for bitters promising strength and vitality. In this class, Derek Brown says they offered other medical marvels as well.
One of my favorite was from Pond's Bitters, which claims that it cures both diarrhea and constipation. Right? So my question, obviously, and your question as well, is how does the bitter know which one to cure?
Bitters eventually were regulated and taxed as over-the-counter medications. Many of them were banned during Prohibition. So what are bitters? Derek Brown lists the central ingredients, a bittering agent and a solvent like alcohol, water, or glycerin. And a little bitters goes a long way.
Oh, my God. Oh, sorry. Oh, that's awful.
So basically, whenever you taste bitters, there's this kind of visceral reaction. It sends a signal directly to your brain that says, you know, these are going to kill you, or that these can be fun. Right? Like a lot of bitter substances, coffee, beer, are things that actually bring us great joy. But they're adversive flavors, so it takes a minute to sort of adjust to them. More than a minute. I mean, a lot of people never adjust to them. It's sometimes disappointing when people come into a bar and they want something very flavorless, like a vodka soda.
No vodka sodas tonight. Derek Brown's class is full of amateur mixologists. On the sleek bar in the Columbia Room, Brown has placed two cocktails in front of each student. The drink on the left is a light caramel color.
Smell it. You notice, first of all, that in the aroma, definitely get the sweet vermouth, sort of like some of the aromatics from that, which might involve some herbal character, some spice character. But you get a lot of wood, mostly from the rye whiskey.
It's a Manhattan, minus the bitters. On the right, glowing with a deep, dark, almost coffee-like color, is the real Manhattan, made with bitters.
So let's try it.
Oh.
I mean, the difference is like lightning to clear sky, right?
The students in this class are going to try to make their own bitters. We start with a little of the plain bitters base, the basic solution of special roots and herbs and alcohol. Then mix in the aromatic bitters solution, which has more spices in it. Now we can choose a flavoring agent, and there are several infusions: cacao, rose and cardamom, grapefruit, lemon, and winter spices. We pass the decanters around.
Ooh,
chocolate.
Really well.
Bittersweet chocolate. Oh, yeah. Ha, ha. It's like walking into the Christmas part of a department store.
Up and down the bar, the students add a bit of this and a dash of that. After each addition, the mixture is tasted and sniffs.
But you already put the grapefruit in, right?
I know exactly.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Could I actually get the grapefruit? I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to do mostly chocolate, a little bit of grapefruit.
The smell in this room is intoxicating. Small glass jars bear the unique stamp of each of the amateur chemists, who seem to be having more fun than you'd expect in a classroom.
I try to teach people, this is not how you make my bitters. This is how you make bitters. And go forth and make bitters. Because it's fun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm happy.
You're happy?
I'm a happy camper.
What
here.
Was yours? Let's hear it.
Cacao. Uh-huh. Just cacao. But now I'm going to add some of the caramel, because it's dark. So just a little bit.
because dark bottle. Well, I mean, this bottle.
Those are some darn good chocolate bitters. I just got to say. Want to have a taste?
I do, definitely. Wow. Like dark fudge.
It's fudge.
Yeah.
It's dark chocolate. So I decide to call mine Fudge Bitters. But the jar will have to sit for a few weeks before the mixture is ready for consumption. Derek Brown ends the class with a round of Angostura Sours, a classic cocktail, made with 1.5 ounces of bitters. The students raise a glass for a toast by Brown.
The well-made cocktail is the most gracious of drinks. It pleases the senses. Taut nerves relax, taut muscles relax, tired eyes brighten, tongues loosen, friendships deepen, and the world becomes a better place in which to live. Cheers.
Cheers.
Wow. That's a drink.
Nice.
And you can find the recipe for Angostura Sours at npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Cheers. I'm Leanne Hansen.
Adventure, theft, big money, ancient mysteries, and death. Sounds like the plot of a good beach read, right? But author Craig Child is telling a true life story in his latest book, Finders Keepers, a tale of archaeological plunder and obsession. It's an illuminating look at the world of relic hunters and some say grave robbers who fuel a multi-million dollar trade in antiquities. Craig Childs joins me now. Craig, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Audie.
I have to say, I love this book. I mean, I was completely riveted.
And
part of it is because you really shake up the whole idea of, like, what's legal, you know, what is an artifact, what is archaeology, and what is grave robbing.
Yeah, it is. It's a tricky business. Just walking out in places where there's archaeology on the ground is tricky because when you find something, when you lean over and pick up an arrowhead or a potsherd, or you see the rim of a ancient bowl sticking out of the ground, you kind of have to decide, what are you going to do next? And what do other people do next once they find those things?
What is legal? What's a legal artifact? Give us an example of one that is and one that isn't.
Just recently, I was up in the Bering Sea, an island just off the coast of Siberia, St. Lawrence Island, where the island is natively owned, and Yupik Eskimos living there are going out and digging up sites and selling artifacts from their sites. And these artifacts are legal because they come from a privately owned island.
But at the same time, you're saying if someone else was there plucking it, you might look at it a completely different way.
Yeah, and you might not get off that island if you were trying to take artifacts from there.
So, Craig Childs, there was a lot of really fascinating information in your book about how people actually go about taking artifacts and then even smuggling artifacts. I mean, can you talk a little bit about how people get this stuff out of the ground and onto the black market?
Well, around where I live, especially over in Utah and the Four Corners area, the artifacts are often so close to the surface that people helicopter in, and there have been cases where the helicopter has lowered its tail rotor toward the ground and actually blown off the surface, where they can actually see objects starting to appear.
And, oh my gosh!
And so people are coming in by helicopter, by airplane. I was out there getting buzzed once by an airplane coming down on the Navajo reservation that was going over and over a site that was right behind me that I had just found for the first time, a large buried ceremonial chamber. And as they were flying over, I was figuring, you know, I bet they're selling this site. I bet there's somebody in the airplane going, yeah, that looks good. I think we can get $10,000 out of that.
So how do legal sales affect the black market?
Well, the more artifacts that are sold, the more artifacts are needed. And artifacts then get laundered. They lose their context until they can join a collection and appear to be legal. So in many ways, there's no such thing as a black market, because eventually these artifacts do rise up, and even ones that are illicitly acquired, they look like they're legal. They look like they're completely legit.
So then give us an example of an artifact that's, I guess, maybe made it to a museum where that journey might have been a little bit dubious.
Well, if you follow the Euphronius vase that went to the Met.
And what did this look like?
A beautiful, large ceramic, almost like a little bathtub that you would mix water and wine in. You'd go into the Met and there it was in its own display case, just beautiful paintings of warriors and gods all around it. Just one of the finest Greek vessels ever found. And, you know, it was sold with paperwork that said, you know, this thing is legal. But a lot of people questioned it. And after a while, it was finally figured out through raids and photographs and notebooks that it was indeed smuggled.
What is the difference between archaeology and grave robbing?
Well, archaeology as a science is holding on to the information. So you're digging up an object and you have the context around it. You know, did this pot come from a kitchen site, a living room, a burial? And you can date objects around it, and you keep this context.
And so there's that balance between what we want, the general public, in terms of learning about history, our own or of other cultures, and I guess disturbing these worlds that are out there.
Oh, yeah. It's a tough balance because I've worked on quite a few archaeological excavations where you're down in a trench digging with a trowel and wondering, what on earth am I doing? Digging through some dead person's belongings. It definitely is eerie, and I know many archaeologists who feel the same way. Even though a lot of information comes out and we know so much more about the past, there's still this sense of violation that you're digging into somebody else's life.
Your book talks a lot about figures who, once they're arrested or indicted on related to wrongdoing in this world, commit suicide, or like these fights and feuds between folks in this industry. And it kind of makes you think of pirates or something. I mean, there is this element of, I guess, danger, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, in a strange way, it's a very violently charged atmosphere where, you know, during the writing of this book, several people that I was following died by suicide, or one woman died in her jail cell. Others went to prison. It's got a certain kind of edge to it that I kind of trace back to the emotional edge. There's such an attachment to what is the right and wrong thing to do with these objects, and what is legal, what is illegal. And it really rises to the surface where I know some archaeologists who want pot hunters dead, and I know pot hunters who want archaeologists dead. There are some bad rivalries going on here.
What does this mean for how you think about what is right when it comes to antiquities?
Well, seeing things on the ground, seeing things where they are, I've come to believe that artifacts need to stay in their place. And that's after having gone through museum collections and seeing just the vast amounts of material that we've gathered already, and going through private collections and just realizing how much we have swept up from the ground. And when I find something that's on the ground, even if it's a tiny thing, even if it's a broken arrowhead, it is so much more powerful there than it is on a shelf or in a display case. And, you know, I'm not saying we need to get rid of all the artifacts we've gathered. I'm just looking at it going, we don't need to take everything. We can leave some stuff out there, and there's not that much left. I walk thousands and thousands of miles across deserts and mountains, and I know, I've seen the holes, I've seen where diggers have been, and I know that there's a lot missing, and I know these last pieces that are remaining are rare, and I don't want them moving.
Author Craig Childs, his new book is Finders Keepers, A Tale of Archaeological Plunder and Obsession. Craig Childs, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Maudie.